That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Former Daily Show reporter John Oliver's fake news show on HBO is bucking the odds. Just 6 months after its debut, Last Week Tonight is beating Real Time with Bill Maher in the ratings. John Oliver is arguably surpassing his former Comedy Central colleagues for going beyond the low-hanging fruit of the daily headlines and outdoing network news at digging deeper into stories that don't get much attention or time in mainstream journalism. This despite John Oliver's protest that it is not a news show, but a comedy show first and second. So what happens when comedy meets investigative journalism? That's the question that Aswin Supsang pondered in an article for The Daily Beast, where he is deputy social media editor. The name of the article spells it out. Last Week Tonight does real journalism, no matter what John Oliver says. Aswin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Beaujean is also with us. He's media reporter for Pointer Online. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be here with you.
So let's start with you, Aswin. For those who have not seen Last Week Tonight, what sets John Oliver's show apart from The Daily Show?
Well, the show itself is usually couched in the same subgenre of television, I guess generally referred to as fake news, which of course includes The Colbert Report and The Daily Show. But what makes Last Week Tonight with John Oliver different is not only the long extended 15 to 17 minute pieces they have, which sort of take deep dives into subjects like the death penalty and net neutrality, but the fact that they actually do, despite their insistence that the show is just comedy first and comedy second and has nothing to do with journalism, they do things that do seem an awful like journalistic work. For example, they'll call the State Department to try to get a statement on Sharia law implementation Brunei, or they'll dig through hundreds of pages of tax forms to get to the bottom of claims that the Miss America pageant makes about how much money they give out in scholarships to women. So there is sort of an investigative element to some of their work that I think they're selling themselves short on for a whole host of reasons.
And it is on weekly. There are no interviews, no correspondence. So John Oliver is pretty much the voice of the program.
He is. And there are interviews, like he conducts them himself. For instance, he's interviewed Stephen Hawking for a segment, and he also had, for his very first episode, the exclusive first TV interview with retired General Keith Alexander. And it was the first interview Alexander gave after stepping down as head of the NSA. So, you know, pretty good get for an HBO half-hour comedy show. Mm.
All right, let's hear an example of one of the stories that you mentioned. This is Last Week Tonight. It's a clip from an episode that aired the week of the Miss America pageant. Let's hear it.
Miss America! Miss America doesn't just say it's the biggest scholarship organization. It backs this up with numbers.
We're the nation's largest scholarship program for young women, with $45 million made available annually.
$45 million. That is an unbelievable amount of money. As in, I literally didn't believe that. It's the kind of number that can get stuck in your head and rattle around there for days, driving you crazy, making you wish, for instance, there was a way to find out more.
Find out more at missamericafoundation.org.
And that is where all this craziness began.
So they began, Andrew Beaujean. Where did they go? What did they find next?
Well, they started pulling 990s, which are the forms that nonprofits have to file with the IRS. And what they found was that very little of that $45 million that was, you know, notice the word available, was actually getting to people in the form of scholarships.
So as a journalist who follows journalists, is there evidence here that this was more than a comedy bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the kind of thing where, as a journalist, you kind of can't help but wish that you were able to get in on that story and start pulling documents and looking for the dirt.
What other evidence do you hear on the show of there being a real investigative journalism unit working on this week tonight?
Well, as Swin mentioned, there are a lot of interviews, you know, interviews that you don't get. There's a lot of what I would call explainer journalism, which is, you know, an underrated and really important part of journalism. He takes on topics the U.S. media barely touches, the Indian general election, for example, or the right to be forgotten, or native advertising, LGBT rights in Uganda. You know, there's a rich vein of stories that are being missed by other outlets that he's really laying out for U.S. viewers.
So, Asawin, would you say that Miss America segment was an example of successful investigative journalism?
Well, it certainly dabbled a little bit, and it sort of admits by the end of it. John Oliver says that this is as far as we got because we got to this point 30 minutes before we had to tape this segment. So
yes,
they were sort of having fun with it, and they didn't dive in it to the way that, say, Andrew or I or one of our colleagues would. But, for example, when I asked Eric Wemple, who's the media reporter at the Washington Post, about the Miss America segment, he said to me, and I quote, "The pageant thing scarcely qualifies as anything but journalism."
Hmm. He admits he's working on Deadline. What does John Oliver say? Does he think this is journalism?
No. He and his staff categorically deny that they're a journalistic operation or organism by any standard. There could be many reasons for that, but I guess the main reason is the same way Jon Stewart of The Daily Show will never say that he's in any way, shape, or form a newsman, and he's just a comedian. Because the second you say you're committing random acts of journalism, you have to assume all the responsibilities and the standards of a journalist and what comedian or comedy writer wants to do that.
Mm.
So, you know, it's an interesting dodge.
The show does have a journalistic fact checker, senior news researcher Charles Wilson. Now, he's an alumnus of the New York Times and the New Yorker. Andrew, watching this, do you think that John Oliver is hiding behind this kind of protection of comedy?
No, I don't think so. I think that it just points to the fact that we really need to be a lot more Catholic in our definition of what is and what isn't journalism now. I think that that's, you know, like race, an increasingly meaningless distinction in U.S. public discourse. There are definitely things that a journalistic operation that wasn't a comedy show would have done differently there. Like, they probably would have tried to get in touch with the Miss America people. But, you know, I found it to be almost like a really good blog post in the way that, you know, they were reporting right up to Deadline. They just shot out what they had and left it out there for other people to pick up.
Well, not only did the show break the story on Miss America scholarship claims, but it also included a call to action. Let's hear that.
But it does seem that two things are true. One, Miss America gives out way less than $45 million in scholarships. And yet, two, whatever the number is, one thing does still seem to be troublingly true.
The Miss America organization is actually the largest provider of scholarships to women in the world.
Yeah, because even their lowest number is more than any other women-only scholarship that we could find. More than the Society of Women Engineers, whose website is here. More than the Patsy Mink Foundation, here. And more than the Jeanette Rankin Women's Scholarship Fund, here. All of which you can donate to if you want to change the fact that currently the biggest scholarship program exclusively for women in America requires you to be unmarried with a mint-condition uterus and also rewards working knowledge of buttock adhesive technology, which is just a little bit unsettling.
So what do you think there, Andrew? What are your thoughts on the kind of advocacy element of the show?
Well, you know, the thing that just occurs to me is it's been a couple weeks. I'd like somebody to get in touch with those organizations and see if they saw any uptick in donations.
So he is. He's playing a comedian. He's playing a journalist. He's playing a pundit in this case, asking for, making a call to action. Is he trying to do too much?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the overwhelming critique that we've seen of the media in the internet age is that we do too little. And I think his own show is a big comment on that. So I don't have any problem with him going from one end of the story to a side that would freak out a lot of journalists, like actually saying, like, here are some other organizations, donate to them.
You know, the Miss America pageant is one thing. Last Week Tonight also tackles heavier topics. I'm thinking of the U.S. drone program. Now, here's a clip. This is from the September 28th episode.
Look, it is completely natural for us not to want to think about the consequences of our drone program. But when children from other countries are telling us that we've made them fear the sky, it might be time to ask some hard questions. The problem is, after a week of looking at this, it seems there are shockingly few available answers. In fact, the best summation we could find of the framework we use to authorize and justify drone strikes is from this former Defense Department advisor.
Right now, we have the executive branch making a claim that it has the right to kill anyone anywhere on Earth at any time for secret reasons based on secret evidence in a secret process undertaken by unidentified officials. That frightens me.
Yeah, it probably does frighten you, because what you just described sounds fucking terrifying.
Well, Andrew, what do you think? Is there a danger to trying to tackle foreign policy in a 15-minute segment, you know, by people who aren't professional journalists? I mean, they could get in hot water.
Yeah, they could. And I thought the drone story was an interesting example of that. You know, I was watching that with my wife, who's a British citizen. And I think, you know, as kind of a side note, one of the best things about the Oliver show is it's an argument for diversity. Obviously, he's also a white male, but he's a foreigner, and he brings perspective you might not always get. When we were watching that show, I was really struck by our different takeaways. You know, she was a lot more outraged than I was, and it's just a good reminder that when you have people doing TV, doing journalism, who come from a different cultural background, you're going to get some different takes that you might not get normally from a more homogenous media.
If John Oliver did take off the comedy mask and said, yes, we're journalists, this is a show about, you know, we're exposing the truth, we're speaking truth to power, would the show have to change?
I don't think it would. In fact, the a professor who the AP interviewed about the show and the Miss America segment dubbed it, I believe, investigative comedy. So I don't think the show would have to change that much in terms of what it is. It would just be a change in branding and maybe acknowledgement of what the three of us seem to believe it is.
What do you think, Andrew, if John Oliver took off that comedy mask and said, okay, this is a journalistic show, would it have to change?
Oh, I mean, who'd want to watch that, right? We already got The Guardian for stuff that we should be reading but don't want to. I think it's much better that this stays in the realm of entertainment.
Well, Andrew, you alluded to this earlier, but I'd love to hear both of your takes. Does John Oliver's success now expose anything about the limitations of more traditional journalism?
I mean, this came up with The Daily Show and The Colbert Report and even Real Time with Bill Maher all the time. Like, what is it saying about us that Americans are turning to commie shows more to get their news? I think that stuff is generally overblown. All the flaws with, like, more traditional news media, I don't think Last Week Tonight is stepping on their turf. It's its own thing.
Andrew, what do you think? Has comedy become a more effective way of communicating journalism, of communicating stories?
You know, it's an interesting thing because the whole show is kind of a meta comment on television journalism and how little context it can generally provide, which is why the one thing that I'd really like to see them do less of is rely on TV reports as narrative devices, you know, to kind of move the story forward the way that, you know, crummy Hollywood movies always do.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see them try to bring in some other forms of journalism, and I don't know what forms that would be, but I'm sure the good people at HBO have the money and person power to be able to give that some kind of thought, the kind of stuff that doesn't always, you know, show you somebody sitting in front of a holodesk saying something that may or may not be true.
Andrew Bojan, media reporter for Pointer Online, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Aswin Soupsang, deputy social media editor at The Daily Beast, thank you.
It's been real. Thank you.
We have a link to read Aswin's article Last Week Tonight, Does Real Journalism, No Matter What John Oliver Says? It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Now, if you remember, Andrew Bojan mentioned that he'd like to know whether any of John Oliver's calls to action have had any real-world effect. In his segment on Miss America scholarship claims, Oliver suggested giving to a few different organizations that offer women-only scholarships without making a swimsuit competition an eligibility requirement. One of the groups that he mentioned is the Society of Women Engineers. We followed up with the organization, which offers scholarships to women pursuing careers in engineering. Here's CEO and Executive Director Karen Hording.
We saw a huge amount of traffic to our website and also an increase in donations. We had almost 45,000 in donations in just a couple of days. In terms of individual giving, that's probably more than a quarter of what we would do in a full year.
Now, having benefited from what's being called the John Oliver bump, we asked Karen what she thought about the show's investigative comedy and that divide between journalism and entertainment.
It's definitely more of an entertainment type show, but what we're doing here at the Society of Women Engineers is very serious. So for us, what started out as something perhaps maybe more light turned into something very positive for, you know, a serious problem that the country has, which is not enough women pursuing these sorts of careers.
Karen Hording there, CEO and Executive Director of the Society of Women Engineers. So, John Oliver's show, Last Week Tonight, breaks news stories, may give nonprofits the John Oliver bump, and can be downright prophetic, even when poking fun at an issue. Back in August, Last Week Tonight aired a segment about the militarization of police response to protests in Ferguson, Missouri.
Since 1996, in response to the war on drugs, the Department of Defense transferred $4.3 billion in military equipment to local and state police. After 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security made additional equipment available to local law enforcement through federal funds for terrorism prevention.
That's right. And this has happened on such a scale that it's enabled small towns like Keene, New Hampshire, to apply for a Bearcat, a military-grade armoured personnel truck, which they needed because, as their application argued, the terrorism threat is far-reaching and often unforeseen, and cited as a possible target their annual pumpkin festival.
John Oliver there clearly making fun of Keene, New Hampshire's Bearcat. Little did he know that riots would break out on the streets of Keene right about pumpkin festival time. For the record, the Keene Police Department did not bring out the Bearcat, even when taunted to do so. Okay, then, word of mouth is going to stay in the wilds of New Hampshire with DJ, producer, and electronic musician Juan McLean. When he is not jet-setting across the globe to play clubs, he lives under the radar, right here on the New Hampshire seacoast. A conversation with Juan McLean when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The track, A Place Called Space, conjures up the neon lights, the white linen suits, and high-speed chases of Miami Vice. But while its 80s-inspired dance beat may seem at home in the clubs of Ibiza, it was conceived right here in the wilds of New Hampshire by Juan McLean. Juan's a DJ and producer and electronic musician and the creative force behind the Juan McLean with Nancy Wang. Their third album, In a Dream, has just been released and is getting a lot of love from music critics. Pitchfork Media described the album as high-def synth boogie, flexing and preening in ways its forebears simply couldn't. And Stereo Gum said McLean's latest is more varied and omnivorous than anything else the Juan McLean has done before. And I'm really pleased that it brings Juan McLean to our studio. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're an electronic musician. You've got gigs all over major U.S. cities, U.S. capitals. You're heading off to a European tour in November. Yet you're living in Dover, New Hampshire. Are you leading a double life?
Yeah, I do. I do lead somewhat of a double life. For someone like me, it's typical that I would live in, you know, New York or Berlin or somewhere like that. But I actually live
in a really beautiful apartment.
Yeah, in an amazing apartment, maybe with a doorman. But I actually live in Dover, New Hampshire, and I have since 1999.
So how'd that happen?
I was in between music careers, and my girlfriend at the time was pregnant with our first child, and her family lived in York, in Maine, and my parents lived a little bit north of Boston. So we moved from Providence, Rhode Island, up here to be closer to them.
So does living so close to a rural environment, to the natural world, do anything for your creative process?
Yeah, I've actually thought a lot about this over the years, because there, I definitely go through phases where I wish I were living in New York. And I think that living in an area like this gives me a lot of sort of breathing room. I think if I lived in a more urban environment like New York or London or Berlin, I would get really caught up in, you know, the frenzy of the city. And being here allows me to sit back a little bit more and, like, not have all those influences coming at me all the time.
Do your neighbors know what you do?
No, it's funny. I felt like I was hiding out here for a long time, and then...
Like that guy from The Sopranos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly, for less nefarious reasons. But they, every once in a while, someone would stop me, like, on the street. Someone will say, "Hey, what are you doing in this area? Like, are you on your way somewhere and stop by or something?" And I tell them that I live here, and they wouldn't believe it, basically.
Well, you are known as an electronic musician and DJ, but in the early 90s, you were a guitarist in a band called Six Finger Satellite. Now, you were on Sub Pop Records.
Same.
People may know that as the same label that signed Nirvana. Let's just hear a little bit of that music from that time. So that's really different from the first track that we heard. Can you talk a little bit about your creative evolution from this, you know, post-punk to dance music?
Well, it's funny because I think of it as just sort of a 180 reversal of very similar elements. Because post-punk had a lot of, like, disco and dance and funk influences. It was a lot of, like, disco rhythmic backbeats with really angular guitars and electronics as well, and so Six Finger Satellite was like a post-punk band with dance elements, and the Juan McLean is like a dance music oriented project coming from a punk rock background.
How about from playing instrument though, to, you know, working on keyboards and working with turntables, doing the DJ thing?
Yeah, that I've managed to get around the limitation that the only instrument I know how to play is guitar.
Really?
So I basically play keyboards with like two fingers. And when we play live, I actually have a series of color-coded tape and numbers on my keyboard, so I remember what to play. But that was part of what made it interesting for me, because I was really not interested in having a music career anymore after Six Finger Satellite, but sort of getting into this world of electronic music production made the whole thing like exciting and interesting for me again.
Well, listening to what you do now, it seems like you have a pretty eclectic musical background. I'm wondering what you grew up listening to. What were the things that kind of penetrated the most deeply?
It's funny. I was really into music from a young age. And of course, it's always the music that your parents have lying around. Well, it was back then. I mean, I'm 46 and we didn't have the internet in the 70s. So I remember actually that Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water
was my first
record I was obsessed with, which is really pretty dark for like an 8-year-old or 10-year-old.
Playing it on the family console?
Yeah, it was one of those things you lifted up the lid and put the record in.
Yeah.
And when I started making music as the Juan McLean, when I was making my first bits of music, I discovered that you could, by using only the black keys on the keyboard, you could play the melody to the song Bridge Over Troubled Water. And so actually my entire first album is made using only the black keys on the keyboard.
Wow.
Because of that. So it's one of those funny things that this very early influence kind of crept back in.
Well, now you've sampled everyone from like Yoko Ono to Daft Punk. I even heard a little Stevie Nicks somewhere, I think.
Yeah, I'm a huge Fleetwood Mac fan. And Nancy is too.
Nancy Wang, that's your creative partner in the Juan McLean.
Right.
Wonderful vocalist. She used to be with the LCD Sound System.
Yep.
But playing as a musician, you're also, you know, a live music. And I'm now wondering what, as a DJ, how you compare that kind of performance aspect.
Well, DJing actually is a performance. I think there are a lot of people who think that you're basically like a human jukebox, like maybe just pressing play on something and listening to a song. But especially for someone like me, like I still play vinyl records when I DJ. And in the process of getting those like two records to work together is a very sort of physical thing and dynamic process that's a lot like, you know, playing an instrument.
I imagine that a lot of bands, you know, they typically want all eyes on them. And as a DJ, are you looking for a different response? I mean, are you casting out and looking at the throngs kind of moving to see how that's going?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interactive, well, it should be a very interactive process. And I really like being, you know, right there in the thick of it when I'm DJing. It's a very utilitarian thing. I mean, you're there basically to make people dance. Hmm. And that's something that I really liked about it. Coming from an indie rock background where I got really used to looking out, and, you know, even during your best shows, you're looking out over like 1,000 people with their arms folded watching you.
It must be pretty powerful, though, to command so many people. I mean, they're all responding to you.
Yeah, and it's I find it both more gratifying when it's going very well to DJ than playing live. And it's also the most demoralizing when it goes badly. Like every once in a while, I'll end up back in my hotel room after I've DJed and it's not gone well, like on my laptop researching graduate schools. You know, like I just don't want to do this anymore.
It's always graduate school.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to some more music from the Juan McLean. This is Love Stops Here. I'm hearing a little more New Order than Simon and Garfunkel.
But it's funny. It definitely goes back to early New Order. I mean, I saw New Order live in like 1985, I think.
Wow.
So, yeah. But I actually think they're not that dissimilar. Like, they both evoke this kind of like melancholy tone that I've always been really drawn to.
Well, I want to talk about your melancholy tone. I know that this album was 5 years in the making. And one of your band members, the drummer Jerry Fuchs, had a tragic death in 2009. Mm-hmm. Any correlation there between the melancholy?
I think the melancholy was always there. But it's funny, that song that we just played, Love Stops Here, was started as a kind of tribute to Jerry. And
oh,
it was
really?
Kind of this, you know, we were actually in the middle of touring when Jerry died in 2009, touring as a live band. And it, of course, immediately stopped, and I just picked up with DJing. I really was playing as much as I possibly could and was away from home as much as I could possibly be away from home. And that song kind of started with this idea of, you know, like sitting on airplanes and looking over, and where Jerry would usually be sitting next to me, you know, he wasn't there anymore.
Well, I'm thinking of the lyrics of that song and other songs. Let's say electronic dance music is not known for its literary value, necessarily.
Definitely.
You know, the lyrics are almost immaterial. You seem to place a lot of emphasis on the lyrics. Is there something you're wanting to communicate?
Well, Nancy and I talked about this very early on in the Juan McLean, because I remember we came up with a list of things that dance music was usually about lyrically, and it was like party themes, like having a good time, and then sort of abstract things that didn't mean anything. And we made a decision to always write about very personal things, even to the point of it being kind of embarrassing. It's also, I think, a time, and this might still be true, when irony seemed to be a really cheap crutch that people were using. I mean, both in, you know, song lyrics and even in the literary world. And I was always a bit turned off by that. It always seemed like a bit of a cop-out. I think it's a lot harder to just come out and say something honestly and with integrity, even though you could be opening yourself up to criticism.
Let's hear a little bit more. This is A Simple Design. Nancy Wang here on Lyrics. To achieve emotional resonance in dance music, or sincerity, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to achieve in any genre of music, but particularly in dance or electronic music, because you have this built-in limitation of using electronic instruments, which are hard to coax a kind of emotional feeling out of them, I guess.
Is it ever odd to see people dancing to it, you know, thinking like, wait, this is about the human condition?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. I mean, that's the trick, really, is like, you don't want to be, you know, how do you make something that's still kind of dancey, I guess, or works in a visceral way without just being entirely heady and intellectual?
Juan McLean, it's such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Juan McLean is a DJ, producer, electronic musician, and the creative force behind The Juan McLean with Nancy Wang. Their new album, In a Dream, is available now, and you'll find a link to more, including to listen to some of the tunes, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Next, we continue our series Good Gig with the executive director of the Pantone Color Institute. We're going to find out what goes into determining color trends for a living. A rainbow of ideas arching over us when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Just as New York Fashion Week kicked off in September, Pantone announced its colors of the year for spring 2015, making 2014's Radiant Orchid so last year. The company that standardized color reproduction in the 20th century is now the global authority on color for designers and paint manufacturers and fashion's faithful hordes. We have deep-seated associations with color. Think of the indigo dyes that drove trade in the ancient world, the woman in the red dress, Iran's green revolution. The fashionable colors worn throughout history represent more than fads. They project mood and meaning and culture and context. A new book tracks fashion's richly shaded marriage with color for the past 100 years. Leatrice Eisman is executive director of the Pantone Color Institute and co-author with E.P. Cutler of Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. Leatrice Eisman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's delightful to be here.
So what a job, a life in color. Is this something you've always been drawn to?
Absolutely. I mean, those of us who are
drawn to color know that, and you recognize that it started very early in your childhood, where every kid has enjoyment out of playing with crayons. But for me, it was more than that. It was like an addiction. I had to repaint my room every other year, repaint the furniture in the room. Even adults would come to me and ask my opinion about what colors to use together. So it's you know, for anybody who's into color, they completely get it. They can't remember a time when they weren't deeply involved with color.
And you continue to be deeply involved with color, and I'm dying to know about this whole choosing of the color of the year. I mean, is there a conspiracy here? Do you get a secret message from Anna Wintour or Miuccia Prada or Karl Lagerfeld to meet in a cabal and decide what it's going to be?
No, it's not anything like that. I mean, I think there are some who like to believe that, you know, we all have this secret meeting together. But it doesn't work that way. We at Pantone really do our homework in deciding on the color of the year, in that we have to look at many aspects of color. Most importantly, the zeitgeist. You know, what is a feeling that's out there afoot with consumers, with the average person on the street? We have to travel the world, literally looking at influences from all over the world. We look at what movies are in the production line. Is there a color story that's involved with a particular film that's going to get a lot of attention? We look at the world of art, certainly. Is there a big collection that's going to be going around the world? Is it getting a lot of attention? What is the artist that's involved? We look at even sports events. Is the Olympics going to be held in a specific year? What is the host country? What are the team colors? We certainly look at the fashion world because that's hugely important. And at Pantone, we do have a leg up in that we ask the designers to send us illustrations in and of a given season well ahead of time. And then the symbolism of the color is hugely important. What does the color say? You know, what is the psychological message that it gives, and that is that appropriate for a particular time period?
So some predicting, some reflecting, a lot of reflecting, not dictating, which is interesting. You're not telling people what they're going to be wearing. And by the way, what are we going to be wearing in spring 2015?
Well, we see that the mood in spring is definitely one of a kind of a cool, calming, quiet zone, as we call it. We have the four top colors all being in the cooler color family, starting with the aquamarine.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, scuba blue comes second to that, which is a little bit more vibrant than the aquamarine. And then a color that really has its roots historically going way back, a color called lucite green, which is almost a see-through color. That is, the name implies that it has this very clear, translucent feeling. And we're seeing a lot of that color for spring of next year. And then, of course, there's always the classic blue that absolutely never goes away. Everybody owns something in a classic blue for springtime and summer. And so that's number four. That's not to say that we won't be seeing some warm shades in the spring. Colors like tangerine or custard or even strawberry ice, even though it has a name that implies that's very cool, still has a degree of warmth that's attached to it. So it's a very interesting palette, but led by cool colors for spring of 2015.
I'd love to get to the names, because for one thing, when you're doing this historical survey back to the early 20th century, color was not always apparent in black and white photographs that were used in fashion magazine for much of the 20th century. So where do you find the material speaking of something as specific as color, especially when they're not named as we might name them?
If we look back through the ads, we found that there were catalogs. Even Vogue put out a wonderful fashion publication, not like the Vogue of today, but very elegant. And in the 20s, I found a yellow-green shade that just I could not believe that this very citrusy, very contemporary-looking color was even available to anybody in the 20s. So it's a learning experience for me, too, as I delve back through the historical aspect of fashion. And that's one of the most fun things about doing this kind of book.
I'm glad you mentioned that about not even knowing that people would wear this color at this time. Because in the introduction to the book, you write about the democratization of color that began in the mid-19th century. What was going on?
Well, it was technology, really, because we know, if we go back really a long time ago, purple was the color that was meant only for royalty. Well, the real reason why the royalty and the, you know, the people who had a lot of money wore purple and the common person didn't wear purple was all about the economics of purple. Purple was not available as a dye unless you had access, as they did in ancient Phoenicia, to hammer these tiny little mollusks open, get the juice, the extract of those little tiny snails, and accumulate that so that you could dye an entire garment. Well, you can imagine that's pretty labor intensive. So as a result, only the wealthy could afford to pay for such a garment. Whereas, you know, coming up to the last century, even a little bit before that, purple dye was accidentally discovered in a lab where they saw that this color could be made and it could be made for far less money. And so literally the average person could then afford to buy a purple dress. That's what I meant by democratization.
So you also write about what color has come to mean through the ages. Black, of course, the color of mourning for the Victorians. Red, the color of blood and fire and fertility and the life force traditionally. How does color work on us? I mean, it actually stimulates our brain.
No, there's no question of that. There's the psychological and the physiological effect of color. If you can imagine going back to the beginning of time, if ancient people saw, you know, bloodshed or the color of fire, they attached the feeling of danger. I mean, red was something that could not be ignored. It had to be looked at. Now, after centuries of being implanted with that idea, that concept, we know red enters our field of vision. We can't avoid looking at red. Our eye automatically will go to it. Now, it could be a warning signal. Again, it's a red stoplight. There's sexual excitement that comes into play here, too, the red lipsticks. So that there's a various applications of the color, even though, if you go back to the beginning of time, it usually was some connection with color as it appeared in nature. Another example I can give you is sky blue. Why is it that any place in the world, if you show people a little Pantone swatch of sky blue, they will invariably say, oh, that's such a peaceful color. It's so serene. It is a dependable color. It's loyal. These are the kinds of words that we get back in color word association studies that we conduct.
That's why I'm told that politicians wear blue ties.
Exactly. Exactly. That is exactly the message that they want to give across. So, you know, we see that color can be manipulated. People will wear it for specific reasons to give certain messages because they know that most people will regard that color the same way.
Color also gives us a sense of time, like what I like to call that 1930s kitchen green, you know. and there's this bright marigold now associated with Hermès that kind of had its day in the 40s, we read in your book, brought back much later by Carolina Herrera.
Yes.
So how do these colors cycle back? What do you think is going on in our history that brings them back around?
Well, there's numerous reasons for that. But if a color hasn't been prominent for several years, if you do bring it back, and the best example I can give you is avocado green, anybody who was alive in the late 60s and 70s knows that it was used in every plush carpet, in every dishwasher, because that was the all-pervasive color at that time. And you had a different mindset in those days. You had people who really did slavishly follow what everybody else was doing.
I want to pick up something I dropped because you just reminded me of it again. The color names that you come up with at Pantone, you know, blue iris, lavender fog, rose wine, glacier gray, opal, hemlock. Wonderful, wonderful names. How do you do this all together in your secret cabal?
Well, there is kind of a secret cabal that does that. And we do it really because with Pantone, you know, we have over 2,000 names that already have colors. So it gets more and more challenging as we move forward. So you have to be considerate of certain elements. Like if you name a color that is just too timely at a specific time. You know, I can remember when we were doing some purples and somebody came up with Barney Purple. And I said, no. We don't know how long Barney is going to be popular. And if that show bites the dust, there goes Barney Purple. So we nixed Barney Purple.
Thank you.
At the same time, thank you for that. But at the same time, there are some beautiful, beautiful names. I mean, you only have to look at flowers and foliage and, you know, places around the earth and beautiful sights to look at that can give you all kinds of inspiration for color names.
So did you buy Mimosa in 2009 or Radiant Orchid? That's Pantone number 18-3224 this year.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have to. It's part of my uniform. If I'm going to go out and talk to people, which I do all the time, you know, I travel around the world doing presentations, you know, if I'm going to talk the talk, I have to walk the walk.
Well, Leitra Seisman, I have to ask you, do you just have the best gig? Do you have
I do. I absolutely do. There's no question of that.
Leitra Seisman, Executive Director of the Pantone Color Institute. She's also co-author of the new book, Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. It is a rich experience indeed. There's more information on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
As an intellectual vibration, smack dab in the middle of spectrum, green can be a problem. That's because there's so many different greens inside of green, and each one has a different IQ. There's the green that should never have happened, the stupid green.
That's a bit of the song Green by Ken Nordine. If his voice sounds familiar, it may be because he's a legend in the voiceover industry, lending his rich baritone to countless commercials, movie trailers, and television and radio programs. But it was Nordine's finesse with a style he called word jazz, which drew the attention of an ad agency back in the mid-60s. The Fuller Paint Company wanted to do something a little different with its new campaign, so the agency asked Nordine to write 10 commercials based on 9 different colors, plus all the colors combined, the spectrum.
In the beginning. Oh, long before that. When light was deciding who should be in and who should be out of spectrum, yellow was in trouble. Even then. Seems that green, you know how green can be, didn't want
the commercials aired on the radio for about 13 weeks and then disappeared. Listeners began calling up their local stations requesting to hear the songs again. But they were commercials, and radio stations weren't interested in giving free airtime to the Fuller Paint Company. For his part, Nordine found the experience of making the commercials so enjoyable, he decided to go back into the studio and record the songs again, removing the Fuller Paint Company tag and adding more colors to the mix. And so the album Colors was born.
Take all the colors under the sun. Only one color I think much fun, and that's orange. Orange, I said, the silly old color who lives next to red. The one that is orangely out of its head, that giggles and titters and rolls.
Ken Nordine based the color's personalities on the music his studio musicians played, giving instructions sometimes like, let's get a groove going, or let's make this one feel a little fat, lugubrious.
Burgundy is fat. Sorry to be so blunt, but that's burgundy. Fat. burstingly burgundy. So, but also soft, so fatly soft.
For Azure, he requested they play something light, like the clouds, giving Azure a sky blue kind of blues feeling.
As sure as there's Azure, it's true. Azure is bored with just being blue. A fact that has caused our dear friend to act sort of silly, like he's at his wit's end. Azure's as way out as wink. Maybe more out than that. Maybe winkier than wink. You'd never have guessed, but Azure can think of the craziest.
If you'd like to hear more colors and more word jazz, we've put together a Spotify playlist of Ken Nordine's work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Sky blue. Azure would rather, so I've been told, let the sky be a white, upside-down bowl.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. If you like what you heard, plenty more is at wordofmouthradio.org. As we continue our series, Good Gig, we would love to hear from you. Do you have a good gig? Do you love your job? Do you go to work each day feeling inspired? Especially if it's a gig that few people do or think of as work. You can go to our Facebook page and tell us about what you do, or send a brief email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org and put good gig in the subject line. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Word of Mouth online anytime, on podcast, the NHPR app, or right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.